Now, there is a free cataracts clinic taking place tomorrow in Letterkenny in the Radisson Hotel, and there are a few limited spaces available for it. Siobhan Doherty's cross-border admin team are part of it with the Cathedral Eye Clinic, and is with me now. Good morning to you, Siobhan.
Good morning, Greg, and thanks for inviting us to speak on your show this morning.
No, no, it's very important. So what service is available tomorrow, or what will happen tomorrow if people manage to secure one of these few remaining spaces?
Yes, so tomorrow in the Radisson Hotel, we are giving people in Donegal and the Northwest area an opportunity to come along and meet our experts at our special clinic. It's running between 10:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. So really, you can come in, have a cup of tea. People can learn then how they can undergo cataract surgery at the Cathedral Eye Clinic with partial reimbursement. So tomorrow what we can do is guide you through the process, help you get started, explain the types of treatments and surgeries that qualify, and also discuss the costs and reimbursement rates that are available. And we'll also showcase our state-of-the-art hospital and our dedicated cataract theatre and the clinic here in Belfast.
And just in relation to that, any reimbursement would be through the cross-border treatment scheme, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's funded by the HSE. So how it works is the patients will come up to Belfast, have their treatment done at our clinic here in the Cathedral Eye Clinic. We will then help the patients through the whole process, provide all the paperwork and guidelines for them to claim back the reimbursement from the HSE that is available. A lot of patients aren't aware that this is available. We're really trying to highlight it, particularly across the Northwest area in particular. You know, we do get a lot of patients that travel up from Donegal, but mainly from Cork, Kerry, because it's really been advertised down there by their local TDs, but there's not a lot of awareness in Donegal at the moment. So that's our aim for coming up to Letterkenny tomorrow.
All right. Now, obviously, there's been a bit of controversy over changes to the level of reimbursement. People really quite upset about that. Can you talk about that to us? Like, in other words, given the reduced amount that the HSC now will refund, has it greatly increased the amount of money that the patient's left on the hook for?
It has decreased slightly, a few hundred euro, but it's still a large amount. You know, if you think about it, patients can still get over £1,000 back from the HSE towards the surgery. And as well as that, we can get them booked into the clinic 3 to 4 weeks. They can have their surgery done, Greg, here, which is great. And especially for people that are traveling long distance from Donegal, we look after all their needs. We can get them booked in one afternoon, come up here, have their consultation. We can arrange the surgery early the next morning, and then they can get the bus back home, or if they're traveling with a relative, we'll work, you know, around their bus schedules and everything.
What's the difference for people pre and post operation, I suppose, or pre or post treatment? How impactful is it on people's lives?
Oh, it is huge. It's absolutely huge. You know, we call patients after they're discharged from the clinic and we check in on them very regularly, and they are amazed. You know, people say they've never noticed the colours of their flares before. You know, they're missing out so much in life. And I think people are going for so many years not being able to see clearly. They don't realise what they're missing out on. And you know yourself, Greg, when you're getting older, you know, it's so valuable. You know, spending time with your grandparents, trying to enjoy every moment. Mm. And when you're struggling with your sight, you know, it's detrimental. It really is. It's very sad.
Yeah, especially when it's... especially when it's something that's so treatable. And as you say, you know, there's been great organisation down the country. We never really, you know, had someone maybe to lead it out here in that way, like buses and what have you. But anyway,
there's
one other thing I wish to mention. Yeah, it's very important. And this is not just for this type of, not for this type of work. It's very important for anyone who might try and avail of these schemes. You don't actually have to be on a waiting list to avail of this. Some people think it's a mechanism to clear people off lists that have been on them for 3 or 4 years, but that's not accurate information.
I'm really glad to hear that. That's the awareness we're trying to get out there. You do not have to be on a waiting list. Once you know you're suffering from cataract, come along, contact the clinic. Even if you can't come along tomorrow or a relative can't come along, call the clinic. Our dedicated cross-border team will go through the whole process with you, and we can have you up here in a matter of weeks. You know, that's the great thing. It's really a matter of weeks rather than, a couple of years with the HSE waiting list at the moment.
Yep. Okay. If people want to try and secure one of those few remaining spaces tomorrow, victoria.gillespie@cathedrali.com, or they can contact us and we can pass that on to them. We'll stick it on our social medias as well. Anything you want to just wrap up with before we move on, Siobhan?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Not everybody will have access to email, and don't worry too much. If you can't register a spot, you're more than welcome to pop in any time between 10:30 and 7. You know, we won't turn anybody away, and we're there to help. You know, that's our main reason for travelling tomorrow.
All right, safe journey, Dan. Have a good day. Take care of yourself. Siobhan Doherty there, cross-border admin team with Cathedral Eye Clinic. If it's something you're interested in, they can have you up there in a couple of weeks. I mean, listen, it's a commercial offering. They're a private company. But that being said, as long as it gets people their quality of life back, isn't that what's that important? So it's not operations or surgeries tomorrow, by the way, just to be absolutely clear, and I'm sure that is clear. It's just to talk about the process, talk about the reimbursement element of it, and to plan it out for you if that's something that might suit you. Tomorrow between 10:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. at the Radisson in Letterkenny. Right, so okay, just some more comments coming in. Morning, Greg. Okay, I read that one. Hi, I'm just listening to the conversation about DCB. Heartbreaking to hear Mary's story. We're on the scheme and part of the group that do not get the extra 10%. We are only getting plans redone, so not even started. We've been told we probably have an €80,000 shortfall, which is hard to believe that a total real build would cost that. The government are not listening. We need to do a Netflix movie and show the real effects this is taking on people. Thank you for all your help highlighting this devastating issue. I'm sure you meant that seriously in that. It is amazing how a documentary or a film changes things or can change things around or embarrass people into making certain decisions. So it's not the worst suggestion I've ever heard. In studio with me, Eddie Bradley, sustainability consultant and ambassador with Antashka. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Now, cycling.
Yes.
You're undertaking quite the journey. You haven't done it yet, or have you?
Oh, no, yeah. I finished last Thursday.
Wow. Okay. Talk to us about it, because it was a long cycle. I'm looking at a map here. You didn't take necessarily an easy route, but a beautiful route by the looks of things.
Yeah. Well, I've got some friends in Cork, and I really wanted to go down and visit them, but I wanted to do it in a more sustainable way. And because there's so much beautiful countryside and so many towns and cities I've wanted to visit along the route, I just decided to try it by bicycle instead. So I just started off the first day, just trying to make it to Fermanagh. And then just took it each day as it came. I had a sister in Dublin, so I was able to go along the Grand Canal, which is absolutely fantastic, to Dublin. Take a bit of a pit stop there, wash some clothes, because it was only taking the very minimum. And then I travelled down through Wexford. I had a friend in Gorey. I was able to stay with him. And then for the last couple of days, I went along the Waterford-Dungarvan railway track, the Greenway there, and then on into Cork. So it took about a week in all. And I took it easy going on country roads rather than the main roads, so I could really enjoy all that there was to offer with the nature, and then meeting people along the way. And it's just an incredible way to travel and completely sustainable.
Yeah, and what did you learn about it? You know what I mean? What were your takeaways from it? Because you're approaching this with, different sets of eyes, numerous sets of eyes, so to speak. So I suppose just in terms of the rural road network, what are your observations in relation to that?
Well, from a cyclist point of view, especially if you're going on a longer journey, it takes a lot longer. to get to your destination, and it's a lot more challenging. There's a lot more hills, there's a lot more turns. I just used Google Maps and put on the bike function, and that normally took me away from the traffic on the roads. But what I found was, because they're so quiet, you can listen to the birds singing, you see deers, other animals running across the road. You can stop wherever you want and, you know, just take a picture. And you get an insight into the nature and the biodiversity that we have, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't get if you're going on a national road. And what I found too was on the country roads, if you're keeping an eye out, people are much more considerate, you know, when they see someone on a bicycle, as opposed to the main roads where people are in a rush and they feel under pressure and they don't give you enough space, and it just feels really dangerous, and it's not really an enjoyable experience, to be honest.
Now, looking at you, you're a very honest person. I can see, so I'm going to ask you a question and expect that honest answer. Where a cycle lane was available, you know, that ran alongside a road, did you use that or did you continue to use the road?
I used the cycle paths, I'd say, like 90% of the time. There are cycle paths which are a joke, to be honest, you know, where if you're going a long distance and you'll find a cycle path, like there was a couple of them in County Tyrone, and you can see that they're going to go on for 100 metres, so you're going to have to get to the other side of the road, go along it for 100 metres, and then get back into the traffic again. But because I campaign for active travel infrastructure, like every opportunity where there was a decent cycle path, I was on it. And
which is really the exception rather than the rule, I think, for a lot of people that cycle. That's what people say to us anyway, especially if, you know, it's a racing bike, maybe with the thinner wheels and thinner tyres.
Yeah.
I just wonder, are we getting that part of our infrastructure correct?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting point and a valid point. And it's something which can frustrate me sometimes, is whenever I see the investment that's gone into active travel infrastructure and people aren't using it. But really what I'm aiming for with the group that I've set up in Letterkenny and for towns in Donegal is for people to use the bicycle as an alternative to the car for travel.
Mm, yeah.
And for that to happen, you know, it's not getting your racing bike out and it's not putting on your Lycra and going off for 80Ks. It's going down to the shop for a pint of milk and being able to do that safely. And that's really where the focus on cycle paths should be, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The greenways are great. And for example, in the greenway, which is close to my home place, between Muff and Three Trees, I see the type of cyclist you're referring to on it all the time. And that's because that greenway is really well designed and there's no junctions where you have to stop and it's easy to get past. Mm. Like so many of the cycle paths, unfortunately, have been badly designed.
Well, it feels sometimes it's a box ticking exercise.
Absolutely.
To be provided, and then you put a white line up the middle and that's bikes and that's push prams.
Yeah.
Another thing too, and it's just an observation, and I'm not anti-cycle or anti-active traveller or anything, but I was over at London at the weekend and the place is littered with bikes, right? These bikes that you hop on, hop off, absolutely littered with them. And the city itself, with all of the with all the taxes and discouragement of drivers, everybody's in a car. Very, very few people on bikes. Now, that's in a modern city, right, in Britain. The same observation I had when I was over in Brussels, they prefer scooters over there, seemingly, and the scooters are just scattered around the place, absolutely all over the place. You trip over them, literally, but very few people on scooters. Right. So I wonder where we're at in that regard. Now, this is just completely anecdotal. It's just my observation on a couple of given days that even where it's made really, really easy and you don't even need your own stuff, that doesn't seem to be the uptake you would anticipate. You know, I would thought I'd go over to London and when you see the infrastructure of bikes there, it'd be like 50 million bicycles. But it's not. Everyone seems to still prefer the cars, even with the various taxes that are there.
Well, I think it's a really good point that you raise, and I can see why people would be concerned that there's all this investment going into active travel infrastructure whenever it seems that the uptake is not where it should be. But for every example you give me, I can give an alternative example.
Yeah.
Like the one I would give would be in 1998, it's showing my age here. I worked in an Irish pub in Denmark for the summer, and I went everywhere by bicycle, and there were very, very few cars around.
Mm-hmm.
And like Paris has been completely redesigned now, and the people have to cycle to get around. And it's vastly
improved. And the same work's going on in Dublin as well. You know, it is to discourage vehicles. There's no hiding that. That's the point that they're making.
Well, When you say discouraging vehicles, I think it's discouraging vehicles for trips that perhaps could be taken by public transport. Like in the Dublin example, 60% of they did a traffic study and they found that 60% of people just drive through the city centre. They don't stop there. Yeah. So it's
so what
it's,
do you, stopping, you discourage them?
It's stopping the through traffic.
Yeah.
So I'm being very cautious here because I don't want to. This to turn into some kind of cyclist
it's about working together for
the benefit of everyone.
Of course, and exactly. Listen, I think that's the way we should go. Maybe you're misunderstanding me. My point is in places like that I've been where the infrastructure is there and people are being discouraged to use, you know, gas-guzzling vehicles, there still seems to be a relatively slow uptake. And I'm curious as to why that might be. And that also is an area that would need some focus.
Absolutely. Like encouraging participation is and it's changing behaviour, which is very difficult to do when people are used to their cars. But all I can talk about is my experience in Ireland.
And you can you can reference that from 10 years ago, right? So you can actually timeline improvements previous journeys.
Absolutely,
so talk to
me
a bit about that.
Well, I've cycled in Dublin on a number of occasions, and just even this time going back over a week, I was able to see the difference from taking away the traffic from the canals, because I came in from Maynooth and I actually had to go on the national roads for a long time, which was really scary. And then I got to the canals, and then there's just so much traffic and so little space. And then the following week was whenever they brought in the new rules where only taxis and buses were allowed in there. And it was just such an improved experience, not just for people cycling around, but also for the tourists that are walking around enjoying the city, also for the residents. And there's a similar picture in Cork. I was a cycle through Cork maybe 15 years ago, and I can't remember there being a single cycle path. And now it's, you know, I was able to go out to my friend's house who live about 40 minutes out of Cork, and there were cycle paths nearly the whole way along the River Lee. Now, and I absolutely take your point that it's going to take some effort in order to change years of going by a car. And a lot of that is because there's active travel infrastructure in certain places, but you can't go all the way and cycle past it, stop in the middle of nowhere.
It's like in Letterkenny. I mean, you know, an awful lot of the cycle lanes, firstly, there's cars on them all the time. But also maybe they have the drainage grid or whatever, and it can be very narrow. And what we see now is more cyclists and particularly scooter riders opting to go onto the footpath, really. But that a lot of that must be down to the fact that they don't feel sort of safe and secure and able to traverse Letterkenny in the cycle lane, because it's the biggest population area, right? And they're there. But it just seems like, well, there's 2 foot of road that we can paint a bike on.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't describe the majority of cycle lanes in Letterkenny as actual cycle lanes. There's European guidelines on how wide they should be, on the protection from cars, on the continuity of those cycle paths. There was a recent active travel consultation for improvements in Letterkenny, so I had to go into it in some depth working with Irish Cycling Campaign. So I've become a bit of a geek about these things. And painting a line on the side of the road makes things worse, because that makes drivers think that, well, I can just, as long as I'm on the other side of that line, I'm fine. But the legal requirement is that if you're on a road with a cyclist for a 50 kilometre an hour limit, you have to leave a metre, and then over 80 it has to be a metre and a half. So it actually makes it more dangerous. And then if you look at those the white lines on the pavement, where, let's say, with the retail park, there's maybe 4 or 5 different places where you have to stop and you have to safely, you know, try and make sure that there's no traffic coming and then go forward. It just makes it safer to actually go on the road rather than the cycle path.
I agree with you. You can see that. And that's why we need to give it the best chance possible. The new cycle lane heading into Letterkenny is covered in dirt and glass. Is it any wonder no one uses it? The Castlefin Greenway is so overgrown. Now, we're not going to go through the individual comments.
If I can just comment the first one, because that's where I come in every day, because I work at the CoLab. And I actually, working with the Tidy Towns, we put in a report to talk about how dirty it was and how it wasn't being maintained.
Right, okay, yeah.
And just whenever I came back from my trip, possibly the best bonus was it had been cleaned.
Brilliant.
So it's free of glass now. So, you know, it's easy to complain about these things, but the council need to know, and everyone's learning. And, you know, we just need to put pressure on them to maintain the infrastructure that they put in place.
Yeah, and I'd also do, as we move forward, right, I think it's very important that we, when we are developing it, so say if we take cars out and make it more safe and accessible for pedestrians or cyclists, like we have a significantly aging population as well, right? So any plans for me have to include access for older people as well, because our over 65 population is going through the roof, and I think by 2030 it's almost going to double. Yeah. Right. So I think in anything that we do, and there has been some criticism of this in Dublin, we have to do also make sure that there are access for people with varying mobility issues. But that's just about getting it right, isn't it?
There's a balance there that needs to be achieved. One of the things which I really found inspiring on the Greenway to Dungarvan was there were so many pensioners on it using e-bikes and they were enjoying it, and it was just giving them a real lease of life. And my dad is 81 and he's on his bike every day.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't let age stand in the way of getting on a bicycle.
Where's our jewels in the crown, you know, of people? Maybe they're not going to cycle from Letterkenny to Cork, but they might want to dip in here or there. What areas really stood out for you on your trip?
There were two big ones for me, where there was a long greenway, you know, not just 5 or 10 kilometres, but you could actually get from point to point.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important issue, because if it's just, you know, putting your bike in your car and then driving to the greenway, then you're not really having what they call a modal shift. So you're not changing your transportation method. You're just going a little
getting
bit on the
car
bike
for a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So the Grand Canal from Longford to Maynooth is absolutely incredible. It's complete. There's no cars whatsoever. Completely flat because it's on the canal. You know, in the greenways, you do have slate hills if they're on old railway tracks, and yeah, you become completely absorbed in the nature. And it's actually a bit of a shock whenever you get back into Maynooth again, and there's all the traffic, you know, having to readapt to it. And also Dungarvan to Waterford is on an old railway line. And you can still see the old signal boxes. You go through the stations. You go into the tunnels. There's,
oh, wow.
There's little tunnels,
yeah,
and you come out. You go
cool.
over viaducts. You see the coast on one side. And it actually takes you between two places. So you see tourists actually stopping in Waterford, spending a few days there, then getting on their bikes and going to Dungarvan. And because they're traveling by bikes, they have to stay there, and they're spending more money and they're contributing to the economy. So it just made me think about the Letterkenny Burtonport greenway, which is proposed, and it could be the same jewel in the crown for Donegal, or the same for the proposed greenway between Buncrana via Bridgend and Newton-Cunningham.
That point-to-point buzz, I know what you're saying, yeah, indeed. And just in terms of driver behaviour, like we have to share roads, and I really wouldn't want to sort of get back engaging in, but cyclists do this and motorists do that. At the end of the day, you know, we do all share these spaces, whether you're on a horse and cart, a tractor, a car, a lorry, on foot, or as a cyclist. And I don't think anyone wants to knock anyone off their bike or knock anyone into a ditch who's walking. But what was your experience of drivers over the course of it? Like, do you think they see cyclists as a nuisance, that they don't see cyclists at all, or is our behaviour good?
It's a very mixed bag. I think generally I completely agree with your point. It's about showing consideration for other road users, and that applies equally to cyclists. So if you're on a country road and someone's behind you, just pull over and let them go past, you know, and then that'll avoid the frustration. Where it can become dangerous is especially mornings before work, or say after work on a Friday, when people are in a rush, and if you're on a busy road, and then people feel pressured to try and get past and not give you that 1.5 metres of space. And it's the same in Ireland, it's the same in the UK whenever I lived there. People, you know, just get into a bit of a herd mentality, and they see the other car just get past, and then they just try and squeeze past as well.
Yeah.
And I would just ask drivers to just show a little bit more consideration. Imagine they're on the bicycle, and if you have someone flying past, you know, maybe 20 centimetres away, all it would take is a gust of wind, and that cyclist will be thrown onto the bonnet and it potentially could be killed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting journey to be able to complete, not least because you had zero negative impact on the planet, really. And yet you covered almost half the counties on the island and experienced an awful lot on the way. And also, too, that's a phrase I haven't heard before, is slow travel. That, you know, maybe we are always in a rush to get there as soon as we can and get the tent set up or whatever it might be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a cliche, but, it, you know, it's the journey rather than the destination is the idea between slow travel. And it, often, like earlier in the summer, I took the boat across to Cairn Ryan. And it's just, you know, it's so much more enjoyable whenever you actually, you know, have a ferry crossing and then you get across and then you just slowly see the landscapes change. You hear the accents change everywhere you stop. Like that's one of the fantastic things about Ireland is that there's so many unique different accents.
Even within Donegal, cycle around Donegal and you'll get some distant differences.
Yeah, yeah. And you just get to, you know, in every place you stop for a coffee, enjoy some lunch. You know, you just get to see what local life is like. And it's an incredibly enriching experience rather than rushing to your final destination. Yeah. and then relax time.
Is there any, and I don't mean necessarily actually just in terms of the infrastructure, I'm on about just the people. Was there any county that stood out to you as being seemingly particularly cyclist friendly, if you know what I mean, whereby that distance was there, that it was more pleasurable than in other areas?
Well, I think it's very difficult for me to say because, you know, I was only spending maybe a day in each county. And in every county, there were some things which were positive and then some things which were negative. Like the Waterford Dungarvan really springs out, and Waterford had a fantastic provision for cycling as well. Mm-hmm. And in Dungarvan, I saw a school class using the cycleway. I think they were going out to a sports facility, all of them on bikes. Completely safe and enjoying it. But at the same time, in Dungarvan, they have this fantastic square and they were having a farmer's market. And all of the farmer's market stalls were pushed up into one side of the square and the rest of the square was used as a huge car park. And there was loads of traffic congestion there. So, you know, there's always points to improve. Yeah. It's just seeing the big picture, trying to be sustainable, reduce the impact with climate emissions, improving the opportunities for exercise for people to be healthy, also mental health, and then just the quality of life for everyone whenever there's less traffic, noise and pollution.
Yeah, all right, brilliant stuff, fascinating. Really enjoyed it, Eddie. Thanks for the insight. You know, you've done it and you're able to talk about it because of your experience. And great that you got through it all safely. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Eddie Bradley there. He's a sustainability consultant and ambassador with Intashka, but also undertook that epic cycle from Letterkenny to... but it wasn't a chore. It's something you enjoyed, Eddie.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It wasn't a challenge. Absolutely. You did this by choice and enjoyed the process.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it wasn't difficult at times, but there's a definite euphoria and freedom of just heading off on your bicycle.
Yeah, okay, lovely stuff. Back with more after these. Now, we were speaking about defective concrete blocks a little earlier on and inviting listeners to tell us their stories, what life is like for them. The reality of the situation. And one lady has messaged in, as many of you have, and this is their story. This is how it reads. Myself and my husband are over 80 and we are killed with the defective block crisis. Mary's a lot younger than me and my heart goes out to her. It will cost myself and my husband €1,100 a month. We put all our money into our house and we have no savings. We can't afford to heat the home. My husband went through open heart surgery. I've lost 4 stone in weight. I have a friend who comes up to visit me on occasion and we have to sit in the car as the house is so drafty. So that's a couple, both over 80. Can't afford to heat the house. Husband, open heart surgery. She's lost 4 stone, presumably through stress and anxiety. And a friend comes over and they sit in the car because the house is too drafty. There's no. Does anyone want to live in a country or govern a country that treats a couple of octogenarians like that, two people in their 80s, really? They've no money left. Everything went into the house. That's their savings. That's their comfort. And that comfort is crumbling down around their ears. Hi, Greg. Thanks for your help highlighting the defective blocks issues. We are rebuilding our house at the minute and we will be using all our savings and more to rebuild our house. We have one child at college and 3 more to follow, but at this rate, we won't be able to afford to send the rest to college due to no fault of ours. It's so stressful on our whole family. So you can imagine as mums and dads, eking everything out to try and put money away to give their children the best chance. But through no fault of their own, the house is falling down and that money's being sucked away to cover those costs. That's a tough conversation to have with your children. How much of our taxpayers' money was spent by the government fighting the 13 billion Apple tax case? Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have egg on their faces in this regard, in my opinion. Who really voted in these TDs? Just on defective concrete blocks and houses that have already been remediated or are in the process, why is there engineers that are saying to use certain quarries for their blocks, even though the same quarry was recently in the news just last year? I know what you're saying is accurate, but just to make sure that I don't identify a wrong business that's not involved in that. But I hear your point, I read your point, but I just have to skip over that last bit because I'd need that information directly in front of me to avoid any litigation, such as the world we live in right now. Mark McCollum is back on the programme with us. Mark, how are you keeping?
I'm doing all right, Greg. Yeah, it's depressing to hear those what's happening with the blocks and the houses. It's shocking, you know.
And do you know what, Mark? I'm going to talk about what you went through, but a lot of people are all dealing with the day-to-day stuff, you know, the historical stuff, the stuff that just comes at us in life at the same time as deal with keeping a roof over their heads. It's shocking, really, because very few people are dealing with defective concrete blocks in its... In isolation. Life. Okay.
Of course. Yeah.
Mark, in your words, talk to us about your story, your background. I know you've spoken about it before, but if you could just give us a quick run through, Mark.
Well, it's just my story, like thousands of others. I'm talking about the Magdalen Laundries, and that's where my story began. As one of those institutions that were operated in Northern Ireland. My birth mother was sent there when she was 3 months pregnant. She was spent 6 months there in a place called Marionvale in Newry, a place designed not to support or nurture, but to punish and hide young women away who were deemed unworthy by society. You know, these places that we should have offered care and safety were just places of punishment and lack of compassion.
How does it feel, Mark, when, you know, firstly, your thoughts are with your mother, and that she was seen as some sort of an embarrassment or shame or whatever
Absolutely.
It might be, or something that had to be hidden away. And you yourself, an innocent baby, really seen in the same light. That's impactful.
It was awful. Like, we were, as children, or children now adults, as the adoptees, we were the embodiment of the sin that they had committed. This was the thinking at the time that they had committed a mortal sin by having the temerity to have sex before and not be married. And then, you know, when we came along, we were sort of something to be dealt with. Again, that's what the start in life we had.
And at the same time, Mark, and I'm sorry I'm not conflating issues, but we heard the report that came out recently as it relates to, abuse in our schools. A lot of this stuff was happening at the same time. So institutions on one hand were facilitating the awful abuse of children in schools and other settings where they should be safe, and at the same time casting judgment on people like your mother and hiding them away. What a world!
It's just bizarre when you sort of look into it. It wasn't just for a short period of time. This was systemic. This was for over 70 years. This went on in Northern Ireland and in all over the island of Ireland. And it's only now that the light's been sort of shone on what happened in Northern Ireland. You know, up to this point, we were aware of what was happening in the institutions in the Republic. But now it's coming to emerge that it was equally badly treated in Northern Ireland as well. Like, I was taken over the border and put in an institution in Donegal when you weren't able to take butter across the border. You know, this was the reality. You know, and the thing in Northern Ireland is there's more players on the pitch, as it were, because I was born in Daisy Hill Hospital and was taken over the border by a social worker who knew were complicit and perpetrating this this system of punishment. They knew where the girls were coming from. They knew where the children were going. And you know, they have their share of responsibility and share of blame in this, and making in this system, perpetuating the system for as long as it did. And it's only now, with this consultation that's taken place by the executive office, that's going to create a legislative framework that will establish a statutory inquiry into the and means for financial redress in for the those in Northern Ireland. We're encouraging people to come forward and engage with this process. The deadline for the completion of the consultation is the 19th of this month. And it's a chance for make, you know, it's a difficult subject to engage with, but it's a chance to make people's opinions and voices heard on matters which are crucial to how this inquiry will work in the future.
How did you find the process of sort of committing your experience to paper?
I find the whole thing, I find it, it is quite overwhelming. You know, because for so long you were told, sure, why would you want to know anything about your past? Why would you want to know anything about that? So you're far better off, you know. And you weren't given information relating to your identity or who you were or where you came from. And that was hidden. And it's only recently now that I found out about where, what of my backstory, as it were, and about my mum and what she was been through. She was a young girl from Derry who was sent off to the Magdalen Laundry at 21, working class family from the Bogside. And I was the only child she had. She went to England then because of the shame and the stigma shortly after having me. And then I'm glad she met a man over there, and did she married. But as I say, she had no other children, and she died very, very young, age 54 in the year 2000. Again, I was never going to get a chance to meet her. Would have loved to have had a conversation with her and spoke with her. But there's thousands of girls like her. I think the academic report that was published in the year in 2021 estimates there are about 17,000 girls from Northern Ireland went through that system, and it's shocking, you know.
Everybody I talk to,
yeah. Knows somebody who's been through that system. Knows somebody in their own family, yeah. Who knows an aunt, a cousin. Has somebody, and the way that there was an Irish solution to an Irish problem was we just, whatever you say nothing, you know, bury it, get on with it, say don't say anything. Yeah. And that's where these voices have been silenced for decades. And it's only now that the people are getting the opportunity to speak out.
What would you hope a statutory inquiry? It's easier to sort of figure out what the financial redress scheme might feel like. But, you know, as you mentioned, very sadly, there's lots of women like your mother who very sadly have passed away without recognition of what they went through. You know, you mentioned the analogy of players on the pitch. A lot of those players themselves are retired or off the pitch or dead themselves. So what meaningfully can happen, and we hope it could never happen again, right? So what could come from a statutory inquiry that would go some way to sort of satisfying what you believe needs to be done?
I think it's just a need for just truth and justice to come out of this, you know, that it's been, that there needs to be accountability, acknowledgement of the worst systemic failings of these institutions, and the importance of giving survivors, both mothers and children or adults, a voice, and why their stories need to be heard. And reparative measures, you know, for including counselling, access to records, legal assistance, and for reunifications, and just seeking justice, and a call for a state to offer, and they have apologised, and for symbolic reparations to those affected. And so that how these institutions reflected larger societal attitudes towards unmarried mothers. And, you know, like these were sort of victims of the patriarchy and the male society. And we need to learn from that, and so that we never allow this to happen again. But we don't forget about it either. We don't just brush it under the carpet. We ensure that these violations of human rights never happen again.
Yeah. And we talk about how we treat children and how we treat people, and you know, we're talking about this in a historic sense, though it's recent history. You know, is there going to be an inquiry into the future about how we're treating children in a different way? The 217,000 children in Ireland that are deprived of clothing and food at the moment in a mega rich country. So I said a little earlier on that we hope it could never happen again. But you just, I need to check myself on that, because we also have to be aware, and I'm not conflating too, and I hope this doesn't sound in any way like I'm diminishing your experience, Mark, but we have to make sure that we're also working on being responsible for how we're treating children now.
Absolutely. Like, we're living, and we're living through now is the most unregulated public experiment ever in human history. We've released smartphones onto children, a generation now that have got, you know, we're growing up plugged into the internet, plugged into online, and we're now reaping the fruits of that we've now got massive increases in mental health with young teenagers and young adults, and we're seeing the consequence of that. So, like, we're still, as a society, still making mistakes, but we've just got to try and fail better the next time.
Now, Mark, this Truth Recovery is being run by the Executive Office in Northern Ireland. Is it all Ireland, though? Is it simple and recognised everyone's experience? If babies were moved into the Republic, or the mothers were from the Republic, or what? There's no issue, there's no barrier to access in that regard, is there?
Absolutely. The shape and scope of the inquiry in Northern Ireland is very inclusive. It's basically anybody that was in, came through that system, was in an institution for more than 24 hours or even less, is eligible for to make a submission, or eligible for redress and for acknowledgement. It's a really, we're trying to make this as an inclusive process as possible, so that nobody gets left behind, that anybody that wants to come forward and engage with the process, that their voice will be heard. They don't have to do it anonymously. They can do it, but because there still is people that, you know, don't want to speak out, or still because
what do you say to people too though that maybe feel they can't phrase it, or they can't write well, or what they say might not make sense. I think I'd be worried that there's some people might sort of erect that barrier on themselves, and they shouldn't.
Yeah, there is a self-exclusion. Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whatever the reality was for people, that's their truth, and that's their truth and their experience. And you can't take that away from people. And that's, you know, people shouldn't be saying, "Oh, I wouldn't be able to do that," or "I'm not, wouldn't have the book learners to do that." Okay. It's not about that. It's about the lived experience, and letting people know what have been gone through and learned. It's again all those things that we learn from it, and we move on. We don't do it again.
Time is short, but people can go to Google, and if you just put in "Truth Recovery Consultation," it's the top three, the top four, in fact, because it's actually linked on ireland.ie. The top four results direct people to that. It's just a 12-week public consultation, and we're coming to the back end of that. There's documentation there that will you can read through and see if this is something that applies to you and what have you. Mark, listen, thanks as always for helping us get that message out there. I do appreciate it greatly. All right, listen, thank you to so many of you for contacting us, especially when, you know, you're maybe putting something down in text that's very hurtful. It can be difficult, but also to share one's personal experiences. But I think it's important, and we're talking about defective concrete blocks here. And this listener, their story reads as follows. "Greg, myself and my hubby are in our 50s. Our house is crumbling. My husband and I have both had cancer as a result of stress. And now my husband has lung issues, COPD. And this type of living is really very not good if you've got COPD. I've lost 2 stone and cannot see any way out," says this listener. "Our savings are all gone into the house and pay the mortgage. The house is so cold and there's mould everywhere. We cannot get moving forward as the housing agency is blocking us at every turn, and we cannot get a decision after 4 years since first testing. We will never be able to afford to rent or move out. It's a nightmare." So you can imagine, with a lung condition such as COPD, a cold, mouldy house, that's another person's. That's just our neighbours. A man and woman in their 50s, nothing to do with them. This is not their fault. They just built a house, did it in good faith, and now look what they're going through at 50, not seeing a way out. Mary messaged us to say BBC Scotland came in 21 and made a documentary on the defective block crisis. RTE came and filmed but didn't do a documentary. That's how much your own country thinks of us. It's not worth their while to make one. I don't consider myself a religious person, but I got involved in the campaign as a result of seeing Paddy Diver's video. It was Easter time, and I say that there was two resurrections that year, Jesus and Paddy. He has done so much for people, and he means so much to them. Greg, when the general election comes along, will Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael candidates be going around campaigning together? Of course, I'm joking, but what is the difference in voting for either one of them nowadays when they have been joined at the hip for the last number of years? How are they actually going to campaign against their pals now, or will they both just have a go at Sinn Féin? One of them could probably stage a big fallout in the next 6 months, but sure, they can hardly do that when they will be trying to get back together again after the election. They should join forces once and for all. You could have a competition on your show for people to suggest a name for the new party. There have been differences within the coalition on stuff. You're going to see more of that, even just down to stamp duty on people buying up homes. There's a difference between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil seemingly in relation to that. Senator Noel Blaney running away again. McConnellogue throwing out of the way. Has he consulted with the Blaney machine? I'm not sure about that or what machines do or don't exist. Hi, Greg. It's great to have the Polestar lights working again. Only stuck there half the morning. What a joke. I think they've got the tongue in the cheek in relation to that. I was away. Did the traffic move more smoothly when the lights were off, I wonder? Maybe you discussed this extensively with Donal yesterday. I was travelling, so I didn't get to hear. But I wonder, say, the Remelton Road, for an example, you can feel quite disadvantaged on that road with the traffic lights. I wonder, did it improve at all when people were just using the regular traffic light rules or roundabout rules? Morning, Greg. I'm a homeowner with defective blocks. I can't understand this approach. It's more of closing the date when the horse has bolted. You know, I read that one out a little earlier on. A memorial or plaque should be erected in honour of Garda Martin Ridge for the Trojan work he did in covering sexual abuse in the Gorta Hawk area. Yep, we spoke to him, of course, over the years. And something a little more trivial altogether. Don't believe it is the reach Oasis has, but the fantastic advertisement team and the hype from the media. Yeah, it could be it, could be it. Well, listen, we're hyping our own fantastic artists. We've got a shortlist of four taking part in Irish Music Month. You can vote for them right now. Zoe McCauley, Wait and See. You can go and watch her video on our website, highlandradio.com. Tessio, Hang It On, or Hang It. Owen Ferry, Miss You, and The Afades Giving Out. There are four finalists. As I say, go to our website, click the Irish Music Month, and go in there and have a vote for your favourites. We're going to announce the winner on Friday, so you've got between now and Thursday at midnight to take to have your free vote there. But it'd be good to see a big rush of people voting for them, because they're all fantastic. All right, everyone, have a lovely Tuesday, will you? Thanks for all your comments today. It was a heavy enough show, I understand that. It's hard to switch sometimes from some serious issues to some trivial ones, but we'll get there. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9, so stay tuned. If anyone wants to reach out to me on social media, by the way, feel free to do so there. John Burton's coming up around the Northwest after the news headlines at 12.